You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Joel toku ingoa, nau mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday. I'm your host Joel and I'll be with you for the next hour. Coming up on the show, for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Cameron Luxon about the government's expectations for city and regional deals and youth parliament. I also speak to the Chief Executive of Retail NZ, Carolyn Young, about proposed changes to increasing the penalties for shoplifting and trespassing from businesses. Producer Samantha speaks to Carolyn Perry, the director of the Brake Road Safety Charity, about the government reversing lower speed limits implemented under the previous government and the potential danger this poses to children. She also speaks to Dr. Makarena Dudley of the University of Auckland about the need for better care for rural Māori communities dealing with dementia or mate wareware in te reo. He aho whakaaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or wire mai rane, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Kaua e ware ware e a hei ana koto te whakaronga ki e nei, kōrero ano hei pakihiri roki roki maronga i te pai tukutuku o irirangi poho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party.
Recently, the government has signed a memorandum of understanding with the mayors of Auckland, Otago and Western Bay of Plenty councils over the government's expectations of city and regional deals. These deals aim to tighten the partnership between central and local governments. For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I speak to MP Cameron Luxton about what to expect heading forward regarding the relationship between local, regional and central government. We also discussed last week's Youth Parliament. Youth Parliament provides the opportunity for 143 rangatahi aged 16 to 24 years old as youth MPs representing MPs across the political spectrum and youth press gallery members to understand the country's political processes, understand how government works, and replicate the parliamentary process. Youth MPs had previously accused event organisers of censoring their speeches. This follows the youth MPs being asked to remove elements of their speeches that were critical of government policies, such as the Treaty Principles Bill and pay equity. However, the Ministry of Youth Development has come out saying the way they communicated their wishes with youth MPs could have been clearer and more concise. The General Manager of the Ministry, John Robertson, says reviewing speeches and suggesting changes was a part of the process, but these recommendations are not enforced. I also spoke to Luxton about these accusations and whether they are tantamount to censorship. Finally, we discussed calls by over half of the youth MPs represented in this year's Youth Parliament from across the political spectrum, renewing calls for the voting age to be lowered to allow 16 to 17-year-olds the right to vote. 5 ACT youth MPs, including the youth MP representing Cameron Luxton, Fletcher Brown, had signed a letter calling for the voting age to be reduced. This follows the Supreme Court's 2022 ruling that found the current voting age is unjustified age discrimination and goes against the Human Rights Act 1993. We also discuss these renewed calls to lower the voting age, but first we discuss the government's expectations of city and regional deals. It is expected that the first city and regional deal will be finalised by the end of this year. When will we see the effects of a closer collaboration between central and local governments?
Yeah, thanks for this question. It's quite an important part of unlocking the productive future of New Zealand and making a happier and healthier community for New Zealanders to live in. You've asked about the time frame. The deals will setting strategic gateways to get people to have the incentives and the ability to partner up and pile in cash and investment over the next 10 years. So we're expecting to see some benefits of this come over the medium to long term. The point of a city regional deal is something that we've been actually, I can remember campaigning on it in the Tauranga by-election in 2022, saying what we need is some long-term thinking here. So we don't have the changing infrastructure choices by governments as they come and go. Cities, regions need long-term planning, and governments need to know that when they're bringing taxpayers' dollars to the table, there is a long-term outlook. So this is going to, these deals over these 10-year gateways are going to be setting alignments that put city regional councils on the same path as what governments are expecting, like genuine partnerships that bring the skills of both local and central government to the table, and making a pathway to delivery that means that contractors and others bringing finance and skills to the table will know that what they're getting is a long-term, better managed plan for the development of specific regions, as the ones you've mentioned, Auckland, Western Bay of Plenty and Otago Lakes District.
Infrastructure Minister Chris Bishop says councils will have to agree with the government's vision of economic growth, housing, water services and transport. How much of a say will councils get in the decision-making process?
Councils have been able to put up plans. There has been a number of proposals brought to central government about what a region wants to look like. So it might be a region that has a strong horticultural base, a region that has a strong ability to deliver infrastructure that can improve their own specific industries. So councils and regions have been working on their proposals for city regional deals to bring to government and asking alongside, this is what we would like, what can government also do to help us achieve our regional goals? So it is a genuine partnership between local, regional and central government to make sure that the people of these areas get what they would like and a bit more certainty that it's going to come. So I think the answer to the question is a great deal of input from the very beginning.
Regarding Bishop's aforementioned comments, has the government taken into account the potential for a changeover in government and a change in their economic growth plans, etc.? How will the city and regionals deal account for a potential shift in power?
Well, this part of the genius of these ideas is once you have regions coming together and agreeing on a set of plans and a long-term vision for their area, and government also agreeing with the government's, as you say, vision for housing development and economic growth, the potential to improve New Zealand's economic and social outlooks. Once these come together and are agreed, it will take a pretty game government to change those sort of plans without having something even better in place. So part of it is just agreeing on a long-term outlook that means that anybody who would like to change this will be taking a drastic step backwards. But also we've got a long-term, the minister that you've spoken about, Minister Bishop, is working on long-term infrastructure plans with the Infrastructure Commission leading that work, and that's been much touted as a bipartisan approach to long-term infrastructure. I mean, New Zealand, we need to get our alignment right on what we're trying to achieve for our country. New Zealanders want better connectivity to be able to get to their businesses, their families, their destinations in a way that doesn't mean their life is spent in traffic. They want to be able to afford houses in places where they want to live, where there's opportunities for social and economic benefits so that you can have a job that you enjoy and live in a community that you want to be a part of. New Zealanders want these things, as all humans want them, but we really need to make sure that we take the long-term game out of this, of people promising a project and then the government changing and that project getting scrapped. I mean, this is why I mentioned I was talking about this in 2022 in the Tauranga by-election. Tauranga is a region that has suffered greatly from this sort of back and forth, starting a plan, cancelling it. The Takatimu Northern Link that links Tauranga north up towards Katikati and onto the Golden Triangle is a project that's been started and stopped over successive governments. We need to take this sort of yo-yo back and forth problem that we're getting in infrastructure delivery and planning out of the system. That's what this is a step on the way to doing.
On to our next topic. Youth Parliament for 2025 has recently concluded, with claims that youth MPs were censored for speaking on the Treaty Principles Bill, pay equity and voting rights. Before we discuss the claims of censorship, overall, how were the youth MPs' speeches and how was the overall atmosphere of this year's Youth Parliament?
Oh, it's good of you to ask, Joe, actually. I was down there for 90% of the Youth Parliament. I went down for the opening and had to leave just before the closing. So I was there for most of it. I've got to say, I was incredibly impressed by the collegiality of the youth MPs. Everyone bringing their own views from their community into Parliament and working together. I went and sat in on some of the parliamentary working groups, which were the things you don't see in the House, where a group of youth MPs, about a dozen, would get together and talk about an issue that's important to the day and present a working group outcomes, their recommendations, and how what they found in their investigations. You know, these youth MPs worked in incredibly collaborative ways. I was very impressed with what I saw in those rooms. In Parliament, there was a group of young people who were passionately defending and proposing their ideas, and that's what Youth Parliament's about, giving young people who are politically minded a chance to go and experience Parliament and get one of the most intense civics lessons you're going to get. When it comes to the question about supposed censorship, I talked to quite a few youth MPs about it. Most of the members I spoke to who said it was a misunderstanding and a nonsense. There was no censorship. That what really had happened was, you know, youth MPs, unlike what would you call them, normative MPs, don't have the level of free speech that a sworn member of parliament has. A member of parliament can't be tried for defamation or other things like falsehoods in the house, whereas youth MPs don't have those specific privileges. And so my understanding of what happened was the Ministry of Youth Development just wanted to make sure that the kids that were taking advantage of this opportunity weren't setting themselves up to some kind of greater problem, and the suggestions were made to not say things that might, you know, lead yourself to future trouble. That said, when you have a ministry give you some suggestions on how to structure a speech or what should be in it, I can see how having someone in that sort of position could lead to someone feeling that they were being guided in a certain way. But from the conversations I've had with members who were there as chaperones and guides for these youth MPs through the process, that was never the intention. And I think the speeches that I certainly heard in the House would lead me to think there was no censorship to speak of.
Speaking more to the Ministry of Youth Development and what you were just saying before, you are correct. They have come out saying that their communication with youth MPs on elements of their speeches could have been clearer and more consistent. This may be a little early to say, but what are the government planning on doing to address these concerns heading into the next Youth Parliament?
Look, on the Youth Parliament Working Group, as the ex-party representative to that cross-party group, we haven't met post the Youth Parliament of this year, so we'll see what comes back with. But it's not necessarily it's a bipartisan organisation, so it will be a bipartisan solution. I would just say that the rules and the practices were the same as the 2022 Youth Parliament. So we'd have to assess how they operated in that Parliament versus this one. And if there's any changes on practice, which I suspect was more the issue rather than policy, then that could be worked through.
As well as this, a majority of youth MPs from across the political spectrum represented at this year's Youth Parliament have renewed calls for the voting age for local and general elections to be reduced to allow 16 and 17-year-olds to vote. Five ACT youth MPs, including the youth MP representing yourself, Fletcher Brown, have signed the open letter calling for the voting age to be reduced. What does this say about how young people generally are viewing the voting age of 18, and would the ACT Party consider having a conversation on lowering the voting age in the future?
Yeah, so I was talking about Fletcher. I would just like to say Fletcher is one amazing young person. He's a young guy who decided that the academic pathway wasn't for him and that he left school and went and took on a diesel mechanics apprenticeship. And he's doing amazing work over in the East Coast, keeping our agriculture and horticultural industry thriving by making sure the machines that have been used to go about the cultivation of our exports are under great care. So, look, people like Fletcher are the driving force of our economy. They're the ones that get their hands dirty with the hydraulic fuel and the diesel dust and making sure that New Zealand's economy keeps going. And I wanted to make sure that someone who's taking that on, like Fletcher, someone who's chosen the trade path, much like I did. I also did a building apprenticeship, and I wanted to make sure that people could see that it's not just one track. You can take on a trade path, and that's what Fletcher did incredibly well, going down to Parliament and representing the trades. You know, as someone who also was working at a young age, you know, you can see that you're contributing to the country, but you're also learning. And when it comes to whether the Act will support a reduce in the age, that's just not something that I think the country will benefit from at all. You've got to think about the chances of actually having that vote. I mean, if you're 17 or 18 now, chances are you're going to be voting in the 2026 election. And if you're 15 or 16, you'll be voting in the 2029 election. This means that you're going to get a chance to vote soon, but also you've got a lot of chance if you want to take it up. If you're a motivated young person, like the people that came down to Wellington with their diverse views, that means that you have got a chance to get involved in politics at a local level, at an organisational level, and have your say. Get out there and get some experience in the political realm. Also get some experience in the working world and figure out if the decisions that you think your peers are going to be making align with how you think about the world, and if not, change those views or have a say on the general conversation that we have as a population. There's plenty of ways to get involved in politics before voting, and actually having people who should be a majority still in education or training making voting choices on who pays the tax. You know, we should be taxpayers making those decisions as much as we can, or at least able to get to that level or have that level of experience in the world where you've seen that happening. So I don't think that the country will benefit. I don't think that we will get anything extra out of bringing that vote forward a couple of years, but I do think that there is plenty of opportunity in our democracy for people to get involved in politics who wish to.
That was the ACT Party's Cameron Luxton on the government's expectations for city and regional deals and last week's Youth Parliament.
That was our weekly chat with the ACT Party.
We'll be right back. Text in on 5395 any of your thoughts on these pieces.
Witness Living Art at Basement Theatre this winter season. Happening now, expect a blistering lineup with a brand new show opening every week, including works from an incredible array of daring, hilarious, and innovative theatre makers.
Soak up the sweat, tears, and blood of the performers.
Not real blood, though.
You'll have to decide for yourself. It's theatre!
Stoke your winter fires at Basement Theatre. For the full program and tickets, head to basementtheatre.co.nz.
Moisturiser, the bold second album from Wet Leg, is out now. Moisturiser is fun, freaky and fabulous. An unbridled display of the live muscle Wet Leg have built up over a few years of non-stop touring. Punchier, prettier and more perverted. Moisturiser is an album of manic love songs and well-timed kiss-offs. Delivered by a clan of the UK's most beloved oddballs. Moisturiser by Wet Leg. Available wherever you get your music.
Hey, want to get in on this buzz?
Well, well, well. What's the buzz?
Good question, actually.
Hey, does anyone know?
Oh, that is a good question. Right. Yeah, I think on that.
Like a Boom reference?
Yeah, it's got
something to do with me. I think Hayden might know.
Find out what the buzz is by tuning in to What's the Buzz on 95 BFM Breakfast with the rotating cast of experts from the New Zealand Drug Foundation bringing fresh news from the world of drugs, including weird shit to watch out for and tips for staying safer.
What's the Buzz on 95 BFM Breakfast? Thanks to the New Zealand Drug Foundation.
Brought to you by thelevel.org.nz. Straight up drug info.
black mascara and little black curtains. Two little holes in my neck that was bitten. Black velvet capes with stylish bat wings. These are a few of my favourite things.
It's the sound of music, but not as you know it. The 95 BFM Monday 1 to 4 with the sinister sister and goth mother superior, Penny Black. Tune in to hear our dark diva spinning nothing but the unholy best from the Devil's Discotheque. Brought to you by Flying Nun Record Store, 202 Karangahape Road.
Thank you.
that was Dizzy the Remaster by Imugi, and before that was The Deadpan Break by TG Shand. Welcome back to The Wire on 95 BFM.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
Recently, Justice Minister Paul Goldsmith and Associate Justice Minister Nicole McKee announced tougher changes to those caught shoplifting and those being trespassed. Of the proposed changes to shoplifting include instant fines, the maximum punishment for theft, and the maximum punishment for theft being increased. Of the proposed changes to trespassing include those being trespassed at one location of a business with multiple locations, such as a franchise, to be able to be trespassed from multiple locations, increasing the maximum fine for someone refusing to leave, and increasing fines for anyone refusing to give out personal information. I spoke to the Chief Executive of Retail NZ, Carolyn Young, about these potential changes and what this could mean for retailers and businesses as a whole. How are Retail New Zealand feeling about these proposed changes?
Well, obviously retail crime is a big issue for retailers. So, you know, having a lot of different tools to help combat crime is what's required. And so, you know, they're good steps to help retailers in different situations.
Under the new proposal for shoplifting, those caught stealing low-value goods could face a $500 fine, and for high-value goods, a $1,000 fine. What is the likelihood of an individual who has been caught shoplifting to then pay these infringements?
Well, that's something that the officials are going to have to work their way through. Obviously, the intention is that it's a deterrent for people that are shoplifting. The thing with retail crime is that there's two factors to consider. One is that we have a lot of recidivist offenders, so people that come back time and time and time again. And also the offending at the high level doesn't start there. So people start at shoplifting and they work their way up to more aggravated robbery and those sorts of things. So if we can put deterrence in at the early stages with people so that we break the cycle and we don't have them continuing to come back, then that's really good. The fines themselves, look, I'm not sure whether or not they'll be paid, and that'll be up to the police and justice to work through how the fines will be issued and how they'll follow up on payment. The key thing is that there is an intention that there'll be repercussions for people that are shoplifting.
Should there be a difference to these shoplifting and trespassing laws if dealing with businesses in retail as opposed to hospo and vice versa?
Well, I can't really comment on hospo. You'd need to talk to them. Our focus in the Ministerial Advisory Group and with Retail NZ is obviously on retailers and some of the things that would make a difference for retail. Having strengthening laws around trespass certainly will be important for retailers to be able to use that legislation in a modern environment because, as I mentioned before, you know, retailers are seeing a lot of recidivist offending and also seeing a lot of violent and aggressive behaviour. So if you're wanting to ensure that that individual doesn't return to your store, being able to trespass them, make sure it's issued with the police. And then if they do come back, you've got a reason to go back, to call the police to get someone to come in and respond. So those are really important, and I imagine that they would be fairly similar probably in hospitality, but I wouldn't want to speak on their behalf. We haven't spoken to them about the trespass laws.
The changes to trespassing laws would allow businesses with multiple locations to trespass individuals from these multiple locations as opposed to just one. What power would smaller businesses have, maybe even with just two stores, having to issue these notices for their locations?
Yes. So the idea is that if there's a known offender that is likely to offend in more than one of your stores and you have valid reason to trespass that person, that it's proposed that you'll be able to do that. Obviously, the bill has yet to be written. It's got to go through process, so it's, you know, it's a long way from being enacted. And secondly, we are still working on some work with Ministry of Justice around whether or not a visual, like a photo, can be used to trespass someone, and whether or not that would then be in for smaller retailers and like maybe on a strip mall or in a high street, where they may trespass someone from multiple locations in the same vicinity. So there's ways in which we believe it will help both small and larger retailers.
Recently, we have also seen an analysis from the Justice Ministry showing that the government's citizen arrest changes will not make much of an impact. Proposed citizens arrest changes will not make much of an impact on public safety, and that there are additional concerns that there will be an increased risk in the use of unreasonable force. If we are looking at both the tightening of trespassing and shoplifting law changes, especially in conjunction with the proposed citizens arrest changes, Does this not put a lot of pressure on retail staff?
So we don't actually support citizens at risk. So Retail NZ, our position is that we don't feel that it's appropriate for retail staff to put in harm's way to potentially physically get engaged and arrest a an alleged offender. So it's not something that we support, and our members don't support that. So we're probably more aligned to where justice are talking about and where the police are at with regard to citizens' arrest. One of the things, when you own a business, you are obliged to comply to the health and safety regulations. And health and safety regulations mean that you need to provide a safe place for your staff to work. If you said to your staff that you want them to make an arrest if somebody comes in and they're alleged to have offended in your store, then you're knowingly putting that potential risk into your staff. You're putting them in harm's way. And so you're not complying with those health and safety regulations. Now, every retailer that we've been speaking to, they're concerned about the safety of their staff and they don't want their staff engaging in that sort of way. But we do think that, you know, security guards, we've been talking to the New Zealand Security Association and they're looking for having a two-tiered system where they've got some advanced security guards that have additional training and additional powers, which would then enable them to use the citizen's arrest potentially in the future when that comes into play. So it's really thinking about, you know, how these different situations may work in different environments and who is best to implement them.
Speaking more to trespassing, the General Secretary of the New Zealand Indian Business Association, Jaspreet Kandari, says the changes are just an extension of the pre-existing law and has expressed concern over how the changes will be practically enforced. Are there enough resources to support businesses and retailers here?
Well, look, if you're looking at police resources, when you look at anything, there's not enough. So, I mean, like, that's just like a blanket statement. Doesn't matter if you are looking at domestic violence or retail crime or aggravated robbery or anything, we need more police. So in terms of trespass, it is something that a business owner can control. And yes, it is an enhancement of the existing trespass laws. The idea is that it gets modernised so it's more effective in 2025. There is still some further work being done around how that's going to get framed up. So whilst there was an announcement last week, there's still further work happening between the Ministry of Justice, the Ministry of Advisory Group and Cabinet. So hoping to be able to use, as I mentioned before, things like a photo to trespass someone. You know, in 2025, you don't know where somebody lives, you don't know their name, you don't have their contact details. So being able to use a photograph and actually issue that trespass notice and maybe capture a video of you doing that, then submit that to the police so that if they do come back to your premises again, you do know that you have trespassed them and you can ask them to leave. So I think, yes, it is an enhancement of the previous legislation, but we're hoping that the enhancements will make it more effective for retailers to be able to control who comes into their store.
You have briefly touched on this, but proposals to amend the Trespass Act are still ongoing. What are you hoping comes out of these proposals?
Yeah, so the key thing that we're looking for is that you can use a visual aid. So you can use a photograph and or a video to issue a trespass notice to someone. Because the fact that the Trespass Act is a universal act and it applies to any situation, it's not a retail solution as such, it's been set up so that often you would know who the person is that you're trespassing, often in a residential situation, so it could be about a neighbour or it could be from a farming perspective, that people that are trespassing on your land. But this is being used in a commercial setting with environment where you've got people coming into your store that you don't know who they are, but they may be behaving, you know, they might be violent or aggressive or they might be stealing products from your store. So you have a reason that you want to trespass them. Those individuals are unlikely to tell you what their name and address is in order for you to complete the trespass forms currently, so that's why a photo and or a video would be of more use.
Is this the best way to tackle these types of crimes, or should we focus our outlook from the bottom up, such as with additional support for people who may tend to steal, perhaps such as people in poverty needing essential items such as food and sanitary products, or people with addiction issues such as alcoholics or even kleptomaniacs?
Yeah, look, I think there's one of the things we know about retail crime is there's not one solution that's going to solve retail crime. You need lots of tools in your toolbox. So, you know, it might be that you have fog cams, you need to have CCTV, you might have bollards in front of your door, you need to have good visual sight line of people coming in, the layout of your store needs to be good, you need to have good staff training and other tools such as trespass will help, you know, the use of technology and facial recognition technology are all important. In terms of who is stealing and what they're stealing, it's actually not related to the cost of living crisis. So people that are in poverty or really struggling to make ends meet, they're not the ones that are doing the significant portion of retail crime. It would be a very small portion of people that are stealing to put food on the table. Now, the supermarkets that I've spoken to, they absolutely, when they find someone that's doing that, they actually usually send them away with a bag of groceries and they put them in touch with their local food bank so they have a way in which they can access food. What we are seeing, which you touched on before, is that people are stealing to order, so there'll be organised crime, gangs, those sorts of things, people stealing to feed an addiction, and we do know that there's been a significant increase in meth in New Zealand, and so that level of meth and addiction is also driving other crimes. And then sometimes there's also the young people doing it just to show off on social medias and those sorts of platforms. So the reasons why we're seeing the crime and the increased crime are not related to the cost of living crisis. That's not the type of products that we're seeing being stolen. But there are issues around how do you make sure that the other social agencies are engaged with, especially with young people, are they attending school, do they have the right health support, is their house, you know, is it warm and dry, is there food in the cupboards, do they, you know, have clean clothes, all of those sorts of things. So making sure that all of the support services that are available are actually, you know, standing up and doing their job to help make sure that young people have got the tools and resources to make the right decisions as they move forward in life.
That was Retail NZ's Carolyn Young on potential stricter punishments for shoplifting and trespassing.
The Wire.
We'll be right back.
Missing out on her, missing out on her. Go tell her you'd like to. I've got a lot of friends, got a lot of friends, but not many like you. We're going out again, going to the end. closer, but closer on the ground. You'll always be the classy, yeah, you'll always be a freak. I know I don't know me, yeah, you told me last week. I always look at me, but a smile makes no sound. I know I can't talk, cause I'm never coming round.
That was Crazy Feeling by Voom, and before that was Cowbella by Italia. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM.
You know, our call is fuck normal. Sorry, I swore. It's important.
That's okay, it's BFM.
The Wire.
Under the previous Labour government, new rules were implemented which lowered the speed limits across the country. However, the current national-led coalition government ran on reversing these speed limit decreases, and as of the 1st of July, those changes have gone into effect. However, these changes have been criticized for potentially making our roads more dangerous, especially around schools where vulnerable school children will be at increased risk. On Friday, I spoke to Caroline Perry, director of the Brake Road Safety Charity, about the potential dangers posed by those changes and how communities and local councils have reacted.
Why is the government choosing to reverse slower speed limits?
Look, it's probably a question I put to government, but essentially they campaigned on that from the election to reverse some of the speed limits that had been put in by the previous government, and when that came through as a speed limit rule, it's that speed limit reversals would occur on certain types of roads from certain deadlines, and if they had been lowered on or after the 1st of January 2020. And so what we're seeing is a whole range of roads around the country that are changing.
What impact will these changes have when children start heading back to school?
So we're concerned, particularly in Auckland, where a lot of changes have happened. So we've seen in Auckland over 1,400 streets have been caught up in these speed limit reversals, and a lot of those are mainly quiet residential streets and including streets around schools. So we've got a number of schools where in recent years they've had a permanent 30 kilometre an hour limit outside the school, and now they're going to have only a variable 30 limit at the start and end of the school day and for a very short distance outside the school gate, rather than for the whole day.
Has there been much of an impact on accidents in school zones under the lowered speed limits?
So the impacts of lower speeds around school both reduce the risk of somebody being killed or seriously injured, and we've seen that happening, and there's been work done in Auckland about what's happened since those speed limits were lowered, and we've seen some significant reductions in deaths and serious injuries around Auckland since those were implemented. But the other thing is that having slower speeds not just outside the school gate but in the wider area around schools and in those residential areas is that it means children are actually able to walk and cycle to school, and parents feel confident in allowing their kids to walk and cycle to school, which also helps to reduce congestion on the roads. It's healthier, it's more environmentally friendly, and it's also helping to reduce the risk of death and serious injury as well when we have those 30 kilometre an hour limits.
Will this disproportionately affect children in certain communities, such as more rural ones?
Will impact students differently and across the country. So some areas we're seeing more changes in speed limits than others. And in rural areas, there are some differences in terms of the speed limit that they see, because that depends on the environment around them. So in rural areas, they might have a variable limit that's higher than that 30 kilometres an hour because of the area that they're in and the school being away from the road. So that's a bit different. But also we see some differences whether a school, as I say, that have had these permanent 30 limits in for the last few years and now are only going to have that variable speed limit. And when we've been talking to schools, we've heard from schools that are concerned because it's not just about, they don't just have students coming in and out at the start and end of the school day. Some of them are split campuses and split sites, so they have students walking between those sites. Some of them have daycare centres and childcare centres on the same site, so they have people coming in and out at different times. So there are lots of different situations for different schools, and we're concerned that it's an increased risk where these speed limits have been put back up outside of school drop-off and pick-up times.
What are we seeing here in Auckland specifically?
So in Auckland, we know that we've got over 1,400 streets that are involved in these speed limit reversals, and a big chunk of those are mainly quiet residential streets, including things like cul-de-sacs and no-exit roads as well, where either it wouldn't be possible to get up to a 50 kilometre an hour limit anyway, or it just doesn't seem to make sense in terms of reversing that limit back up to 50. And it also means we start to see some areas where you're going to have lots of different speed limits. So Freeman's Bay, for example, which has been a 30 limit for a big part of the area, will now have some streets at 30, some at 50, and a couple that are still at 40 as well. So it's a real mixture of areas there, which makes it more confusing for drivers also.
This change was made without local council or community approval. How have local councils and communities reacted?
We've seen councils react in different ways. Obviously, all councils have to adhere to the rules, so they've had to implement it, but they've been able to figure out for themselves which roads will be caught up in these changes, and so they've been able to identify locally what that means for them. And what we've seen is quite a range around the country between some councils, towns and cities that it's only affected a small number of roads, through to Auckland, which has over 1,400 swept up in these reversals here. But we are hearing from a lot of communities who are concerned and are only just starting to realise what it sort of means for some of their communities. So some have seen an impact and been able to keep their lower speed limits. So, for example, Rakaia and Nelson on the South Island that were due to have reversals as part of the state highway changes were able to go out to public consultation on those proposed speed limits increases, and there was community pushback, so they've been able to keep their lower speed limits, which is good for them. So we've seen a real mix on the country, but we're starting to hear more and more from communities and schools who are really concerned about increases in speed limits and what that means for their community. And some of them where they've had changes in their communities because there's been more housing developments in the last few years, other changes locally, which means that a higher speed limit isn't appropriate.
What would you like to see in response to this move from both government and schools?
So from government, what we'd be like to see, the rule is obviously has come into force and things being changed. From government, we would really like to see the rule amended to at least have 30 kilometres an hour as an option for a speed limit. Currently, the rule as it's written means that new 30 kilometre an hour limits can't be brought in other than the variable limits outside schools. And we would like to see that as an option for communities and residential areas, whereas currently the lowest limit it could be is 40 kilometres an hour. We also would encourage councils to start working with their communities and communities who are concerned about their speed limits or other road safety issues to go to their local council and talk to them about their concerns, because you can go out to consultation and obviously look at in future changing speed limits or making other road safety improvements to areas that need it as well. In terms of schools, part of it is going to be talking to parents and the community about the changes that are happening outside their school, if you're a school that's been affected. But I'd also say if you have particular concerns, again, council is a good place to start. And you can also talk to Brake as well, and we can help where we can in terms of raising awareness if you've got particular issues there.
What advice would you give to parents concerned about their children's safety around our roads?
That we've all got a responsibility in terms of road safety. So for parents, it's always a good idea to start teaching road safety from a young age so that children are used to that and that it's an ongoing learning experience. So in terms of being safe when you're walking, when you're cycling or scooting, and also when you're in the car, sitting in a car seat as well, and the importance of some of those key safety lessons. But it's also important for us as drivers. Children are young, their brains are still developing. They also can't accurately determine the speed of traffic that's going faster than 30 kilometres an hour. So the responsibility is on us as adults and us as drivers to look out and pay special attention to look out for children when we're around schools, and also when we're around other things like childcare centres, playgrounds, community centres, other places where children might be as well.
Is there anything communities can do to ensure safe driving in school zones?
Well, I urge drivers to obviously drive below the speed limits during those school hours when the variable speed limits are in effect, but also to slow down and pay attention at other times as well, and to note that even though you might have a variable speed limit in place only at certain times, that actually there might still be children around outside of those times and in the surrounding streets as well who may be making their way to and from school. So it's really important that it's not just outside the school gate, but you're paying attention, keeping your mind and eyes focused 100% on the road, on the task of driving, looking out for potential hazards in those areas. And it's those same messages that we say for all road safety things. It's keeping below speed limits, driving to the conditions, ensuring everyone's wearing a seatbelt, and not driving impaired or fatigued as well, but particularly paying attention in places where children might be, that may be around, and that something unexpected might happen.
Well, that was my final question. Do you have anything you'd like to add?
I think we've covered a lot there. I did realise I didn't give the stat. I don't know if you want the stats about that. We also know that 85% of crashes that injure or kill people on streets around schools happen outside of those short periods at the beginning and end of the school day. And that's particularly an Auckland piece of research. So in Auckland, we know that the majority of serious crashes around schools happen outside of normal school drop-off and pick-up times. So that's the reason why we're particularly concerned about only having variable speed limits for a short period of time.
That was Caroline Perry, director of the Brake Road Safety Charity, on the government raising speed limits and the implications that has for road safety, especially where children are at risk.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I korero mai ki maua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Monday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today, the ACT Party's Cameron Luxton, Retail NZ's Carolyn Young, and Brake's Carolyn Perry. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakaronga ana, thank you for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.